You're listening to Life, the Universe, and Everything Else. Today on the show, we have some skeptical news. Life, the Universe, and Everything Else is a program promoting secular humanism and scientific skepticism that is produced by the Winnipeg Skeptics and the Humanists, Atheists, and Agnostics of Manitoba. You can email your questions, comments, or criticisms to us at luepodcast@winnipegskeptics.com, or you can reach us on Twitter or Facebook at @LUEEpodcast. My name is Rochelle, and today with me here, I have the gregarious Jem Newman.
That's me.
And also the indomitable Donna Harris.
Thank you so much. Hi, everyone.
So today we're going to talk about a couple news items that we found interesting in the past couple weeks. But first, some announcements. Donna?
Thank you very much. For those who are interested and in the Winnipeg area, our next meeting of the Humanist, Atheist, and Agnostics of Manitoba is going to take place on February 9th at the Canad Inn Polo Park. It starts at 5:30 p.m., and our special guest speaker this month is going to be Jay Anderson. He's a meteorologist as well as an amateur astronomer. It should be really fun.
Cool.
What's he going to be talking about?
We don't have a particular top topic yet because, you know, he might just get attacked about what's happening with the weather. But considering we're like snow nonstop, or he may be doing something on the astronomy-based aspect of things, like how to be an amateur astronomer and how to start sky watching and things like that. So should be pretty cool.
Sounds excellent. What's going on with Winnipeg Skeptics, Jem?
Well, on February 12th, we're having our monthly Drinking Skeptically event at the Wood Tavern at the Norwood Hotel. Our speaker this month will be Dr. Laura Targofnik, who is a regular on this show. February 12th is a Tuesday, and that is the day before the third anniversary of the Winnipeg Skeptics. The group has been around for 3 years now.
Yay!
Yay! Happy birthday!
Happy birthday, yes.
I don't think I've mentioned this on the show before yet. I've been organizer of the Winnipeg Skeptics since it began in February of 2010. I'll be stepping back from the role of organizer, although I'll still be involved in the leadership of the group. Ashlyn Noble will be stepping forward to be the organizer of the Winnipeg Skeptics, because I'm hoping to spend more time with my family. That's all. So in February, I'll still be around, but I will sort of not be around as much.
Absolutely. And you'll probably be taking a break from these podcasts as well, I imagine.
A little bit. I'll still be involved from time to time, and I'll still be doing all of the webmastering. But I hope that I'll be able to get back to doing some Where's My Jetpack segments.
Oh, excellent. All right. Well, let's dive right on into the news then. For our first news story, why don't we talk about what Badge Science Watch has been up to?
So Bad Science Watch, as our listeners may be aware, is an independent, nonprofit activist organization dedicated to improving the lives of Canadians by countering bad science. So the group is driven by a vision of a safer, healthier, and more prosperous Canada, where critical thinking and sound science are paramount in the making of important societal decisions. For the sake of full disclosure, as we've mentioned before, both Rochelle and I are on the steering committee of Bad Science Watch, and we have been since the group launched last year. And I also served as project chair for a recent project that investigated anti-Wi-Fi activism in Canada. We presented our findings to Bad Science Watch in December, and the full report that we presented is now available on Bad Science Watch's project page on their website. So you can go to badsciencewatch.ca and check that out. We'll also link to it in the show notes. What we did is we looked both at the science that underlines claims that people are suffering from electromagnetic hypersensitivity. Spoiler alert, there isn't much in the way of science. And we also took a close look at the individuals and groups that are promoting this pseudoscience through activism and, in some cases, questionable research. I'll just say that idiopathic environmental intolerance attributed to electromagnetic fields, IEI EMF, that's the proper term that the World Health Organization settled on to refer to electromagnetic hypersensitivity. And the reason for that is that electromagnetic hypersensitivity implies that there is a causal connection between electromagnetic fields, like from Wi-Fi or cell towers, for example. It implies that electromagnetic fields have any causal connection to the symptoms attributed to EMF. But the science has shown that that's not the case. or at least there's no reason to believe that that is the case. And so they have adopted the terminology of idiopathic environmental intolerance attributed to electromagnetic fields instead of electromagnetic hypersensitivity.
It's a bit more of a mouthful, though.
So IEI EMF. We'll just call it that. So,
instead of IEIEIO, yeah.
I'll quote from the conclusion of the report.
We've been unable to identify any high-quality reproducible evidence that any symptom of IEI EMF is caused by exposure to non-ionizing electromagnetic radiation. Systematic reviews of both provocation studies and purported treatments for IEI EMF support the conclusion that EMF is not the cause of this syndrome. Despite the claims made by the authors of one review paper and the aforementioned anti-Wi-Fi groups, Bad Science Watch was unable to locate any compelling evidence of legitimate scientific debate about Wi-Fi-induced illness or the safety of low-level EMF exposure in general. While fringe groups continue to present flawed arguments and promote poorly designed experiments, the preponderance of research on the matter robustly dispels the connection between Wi-Fi and IEI EMF. For those tasked with making decisions about the inclusion of Wi-Fi technology in their organization, school, or home, we can find no reason to ignore the advice of health organizations worldwide. The benefits of Wi-Fi are numerous and varied, and there is no compelling evidence that any health effects arise as a result of this technology. So, to summarize the report, we found several researchers and activists in Canada who are promoting a supposed connection between Wi-Fi and this so-called electromagnetic hypersensitivity syndrome. However, there is no science to support any such connection. Magda Havas and Rob Metzinger and Kevin Byrne, all of these activists are going to continue banging their drums, David Stetzer. However, they don't have a scientific leg to stand on. And what they're doing is they're basically fear-mongering. They're making people, they're turning Wi-Fi into a boogeyman that people are afraid of. And they're limiting people's options when it comes to wireless communication needlessly, and they're profiting from it. We identified several concerning conflicts of interest between activists and researchers who are profiting directly and indirectly from this fear-mongering, whether it's selling their books and seminars or selling supposed devices that are supposed to shield you from the supposed negative impacts of Wi-Fi and other EMF sources. So these people are fear-mongering and they're making a buck off of it, and that's unacceptable.
So the sort of things they're selling, is that like the cell phone shields that don't allow your cell phone to send or transmit data?
Yeah, so that's one of the things that are being sold. So you have shielding for your cell phone or for your laptop that's supposed to block the harmful electromagnetic radiation. However, the extent to which any such technology works it requires that the signal be transmitted. So if these devices are successful in blocking the signal, your device is going to stop working, your phone won't receive calls or data, and if the device allows your phone to receive calls and data, then it's not actually blocking the supposedly harmful signal.
Yes.
You also have things like Graham Stetzer filters, which are supposed to filter the electromagnetic radiation emanating from wiring in your house, which doesn't work.
But then you won't have any ghosts.
Yes. Yeah. As we've learned from all of those ghost hunting shows, ghosts are a robust source of electromagnetic radiation. Otherwise,
right.
Yeah, that's what they're scanning for with those little e-meters, right? So,
So Jim, I can then now take my cell phone or my laptop, and I don't have to worry about the Wi-Fi at my local coffee shop. My phone, anything like that, right? Is this at all related to the old days when it used to be you don't have your cell phone right close to your head because of the radiation that's emitting, or is the Wi-Fi argument something different?
Yes and no. Wi-Fi is broadcasting in the same a very similar frequency range on the electromagnetic spectrum that cell phones use. They're both in the radio frequency range of the EM spectrum. They're both non-ionizing, and what that means is that they're not of sufficiently high frequency, sufficiently high power to break electrochemical bonds. So they don't break molecules up into ions. Basically, okay. that's what ionizing means. So these are non-ionizing forms of radiation. Ionizing radiation is known to do direct DNA damage. So it causes cancer. So ultraviolet radiation, for example, causes cancer via direct DNA damage. It's right on the cusp of ionization. So it also can cause indirect damage to DNA via thermal effects. So some of the cancers, they're saying now that some of the cancers are not directly caused by ionizing radiation in UV. It's right on the cusp. In any event, Wi-Fi and cell phone radiation and the radio waves that that you know, CJOB, Bob FM, those guys are broadcasting through your brain right now. Those are all non-ionizing.
I knew CJOB was talking to me.
Yeah,
I know. I can hear them
through the fillings in your teeth, right?
The fillings, yes.
Yes.
So non-ionizing radiation won't do direct DNA damage. However, there are potential effects that it can have on living tissue via thermal damage. So your microwave oven, for example, you don't want to microwave a living thing. It would kill it via dielectric heating, which is a thermal effect. So you don't want to stick your hand in the microwave and turn it on. Luckily, there are safeties that prevent that from happening.
Right.
If you take your Wi-Fi hotspot and put it on your genitals and leave it there for a long time, it might heat up a little bit. It might eventually cause a little bit of thermal damage. Certainly not much, and you're going to notice it as heat, you know. And the point at which the heat becomes painful, you remove the Wi-Fi hotspot.
Right.
Wi-Fi is also significantly lower powered than cell phone, so you don't need nearly as much. Trying to sort of translate this into non-technical terms here. It is, even if there were a reason to worry about cell phones causing damage, and there is no such reason, but even if there were a reason to worry about your cell phone, there would be orders of magnitude less reason to worry about Wi-Fi. And there's currently no robust scientific evidence that either of them cause either cancers or cause this supposed electromagnetic hypersensitivity, or I should say idiopathic environmental intolerance attributed to electromagnetic fields.
Yay! I can go back to the Wi-Fi at the coffee shop.
Yeah.
Wonderful. Thanks, Jim.
No problem. So Bad Science Watch is currently working on another project. They're just finishing off a project involving an investigation of homeopathic nosodes. So what they're saying is that they're trying to get Health Canada to deregister homeopathic nosodes. And what a nosode is a supposed alternative to vaccines that are promoted by homeopaths and naturopaths, etc. They're currently approved by Health Canada for sale under the Natural Health Products Directorate. Their approval implies that they have efficacy similar to vaccines. However, there is actually no evidence that they provide any protection at all. And in fact, if you know anything about homeopathy, you'll recognize that there is substantial evidence that they provide no protection at all. And this contradicts Health Canada's own clear pro-vaccination policies. So this deregistration of homeopathic nosodes project on the part of Bad Science Watch is nearing completion. However, Bad Science Watch is always looking for volunteers. So if you are looking to help out by volunteering with Bad Science Watch, something that we'll all encourage you to do, or if you're looking to donate to Bad Science Watch, then you can visit the Bad Science Watch website and follow the links for details.
Excellent. So, the next thing I want to talk about is an interesting systematic review that was published last week, I believe, in the Annals of Family Medicine, so a reasonably large medical journal. And I think it's interesting because it's incredibly seasonal right now, because it's a systematic review of how long patients think that a cough should last, as opposed to how long a cough actually lasts. So we're right in the middle of cold and flu season. I know I'm just getting over one myself. And so what they did was they did a random digit dialing survey of people in Georgia, the states, and basically called them up and asked them how long, if you got a cough, how long do you think it would last? So what would you guys guess if you haven't read the article yet?
Oh, that's a good question. So if I, just for whatever reason, if I had a cough, how long do I think the cough should last?
Yeah, like if you came down with like a nasty cold and were like hacking up things, how long do you think you would still be coughing for?
Well, I'd say the main body of the cough might last for 4 days, and then I might, you know, still have a dry, coughy sort of throat for another two.
How about you, Donna?
That is about what I was going to say. Maybe about a week, maybe a little more, but certainly clearing up by that point.
Well, you guys are perfectly average then, because survey respondents reported a mean duration of 5 to 7 days, and with a little, potentially a bit longer if there was a different scenario of 7 to 9 days. So you guys have pretty much the same expectations as all these people they surveyed. They surveyed 500 adults.
And were our expectations stupid?
Well, I wouldn't say stupid, but dramatically...
Unrealistic?
Dramatically unrealistic. So what they found in the published literature...
What? I have unrealistic expectations? Don't tell my wife. Be astonished.
Yes. So the mean duration of a cough, of just, you know, for any random illness in an adult, a healthy adult, is 18 days.
Oh.
Yeah. So some patients think that they're going to have a longer duration, and those are the people who have asthma or chronic lung disease, people who know when they get sick it's not going to be good. But yeah, I thought that's interesting that, you know, it's like twice as long as or and longer than people expect. And so what happens is they end up going to their doctor and asking for antibiotics for a cough that is going to resolve on its own in the next 5 to 7 days that you happen to be taking those antibiotics.
Mm. Right. And if this is a viral infection, there's no reason to think that antibiotics would be effective, right?
No, and it's also really important to not overprescribe antibiotics, which is a major problem we're having, is that antibiotics stop working because bacteria are evolving to be resistant.
But since we know that evolution is false, we can use as many antibiotics as we want.
Yes, of course. If you go to your family doctor and you say, you know what, I've been sick with this cough for 2 weeks and it's still not getting better, you know, that, I think that would be a reasonable time. If people expect it to last a week and it's lasting two, you'd probably go, okay, maybe it's time to get this checked out. And your doctor is just going to prescribe you a general broad-spectrum antibiotic that's going to hit lots of different things. And when you combine that with the fact that people usually don't finish their antibiotic prescriptions, I know I am so guilty of this.
No, don't do it, Rochelle.
Oh, no.
I know. I it's absolutely terrible, but I'm incredibly forgetful. And so if I'm not hacking up something, I will sometimes just forget to take the last two doses because I'm a horrible person. Don't do that. It's very bad. Don't do it.
Yes.
But yeah, so it's sort of like you've got these... You're treating people with an antibiotic that is unnecessary, and then on top of that, people don't necessarily do the full dosage, so you're just basically priming a whole bunch of bacteria that are just kicking around not being harmful to evolve into something which is resistant to antibiotics and could harm somebody else. So,
mm-hmm. So perhaps then the best advice is to just stay home, expect a few more days of that cough, maybe arm yourself with a little bit more cough syrup and things and just have some patience and wait it out.
Yeah, absolutely. Like if your symptoms are really concerning, like for example, if you've caught influenza, which is not the stomach flu, but more of a coughy respiratory thing, And you are having high fevers and losing weight and, generally not doing well, then yeah, you should absolutely go to your doctor. But if, you have a kind of a dry cough and you're otherwise feeling fine, if you're at day 18, kind of go, well, now maybe I should start thinking about getting this checked out, not on day 7.
Right, right. Okay. Good to know. Good to know.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, one of the other things that the one of the other things that the paper found was that people who had previously been prescribed antibiotics for an upper respiratory infection were more likely to want antibiotics. And so it's also important to remember that there's different causes of cough. They feel the same, they look the same, but they're not necessarily... Just because you've had strep throat once doesn't mean the next time you get a sore throat it's strep throat, right?
Yep.
So it's important to keep that in mind.
Well, true. I would automatically, or I would get a little concerned or skeptical there, because thinking you go to the doctor, you get these antibiotics, your illness was on the way out anyway, so in a couple of days you feel better, and you go, hey, it was the antibiotics. However, it may just have been that you were getting better on your own. So
yeah.
There really is not the link there for the future episodes.
Well, yeah.
On a similar note. Oh, there have been several recent randomized controlled trials that have found that cough, like over-the-counter cough suppressant syrups, are not really more effective than placebo.
Mm-hmm.
The results have varied, but they're not going to do you any harm.
Unless you're a kid. Do not give your kids...
Don't bother.
Like with some of this children's medicines, there's so much placebo effect going on, and it's sort of one of those things you got to wait it out.
Laura and I were in the, speaking of placebo medicine for kids, Laura and I were in Babies R Us just the other day, and they have several aisles dedicated to medicine for children, and a good one-third of all of the medicines there were homeopathic in the medical aisle.
Wow.
For children. It filled me with rage and despair.
I really can't express my facepalm in a appropriate way that is going to portray over a podcast. But it is really common. I know this is totally derailing it, but I know for teething, it's really common to use homeopathic stuff. I have lots of people who have just said, oh, this is supposed to be really great for it, and I look into it, and it's a homeopathic remedy.
Absolutely.
I mean... Yeah, it's you want to do something for teething because there's not really anything you can do and you can feel helpless and, your kid's been crying for 12 hours and you're just desperate. So I understand why people do it, but...
There's so much pseudoscience surrounding teething. Have like those special magic amber pendants, all sorts of stuff.
Yeah, it just take some Vaseline, it'll be cheaper, rub that on their gums, give them a little gum massage, and there you go. Pretend it's homeopathic. It's just as good.
It's placebo homeopathy.
There we go.
It's like a double placebo effect. It's like a double rainbow.
But change the cover on the Vaseline.
Make
your own label on there. And
Yeah. Anyway. Donna, what do you have for us today?
Well, what I wanted to start out with today was this interesting study that is just being published, I think just a couple of days ago, in the Journal of Health Politics, Policy, and Law. It's a long title, but it's really interesting. It's called The Arrests of and the Forced Interventions on Pregnant Women in the United States. This is a study that the longitudinal from 1973 to 2005, and it covers the implications for women's legal status and public health. Basically, what the two authors found, Lynn Paltrow and Jean Flavin, is that there's instead of the anti-choice and pro-life measures being used to do more than limit access to abortion, they're also providing the basis for arresting women, locking them up, and forcing them to submit to medical interventions, including surgery. They managed over that time frame to identify 413 criminal and civil cases that involved the arrest, detention, and equivalent deprivations of pregnant women and their physical liberty, that are just astonishing. And what they're considering here is that they know that this is an underreported event. They're looking at data collection processes now that indicate there's at least another 255 cases since 2005.
So what exactly is going on here? Are police just rounding women up off of the streets? Or like, what's the context?
Okay, what they've given is they've given some examples from their study. There's a woman who gave birth to twins. When one was stillborn, she was arrested and charged with criminal homicide based on the claim that her decision to delay cesarean surgery was the causes of the stillbirth. So
What?
that, yes. This is a United States study, so these are all examples from United States. There was another example from Texas. There was a pregnant woman who sometimes smoked marijuana. This is to ease nausea, boost her appetite. She was pregnant with twins. She gave birth to healthy twins. However, she was arrested for delivery of a controlled substance to a minor. So
What?
In what sense? In the sense that she was delivering a controlled substance to her fetuses?
Exactly. So what is
But those
happening?
aren't minors. You can't, how can you claim that a fetus is a minor?
Well,
It
no. Many states have passed feticide
persons
measures
at
and
laws.
yes,
Yeah.
exactly, and laws restricting access to safe abortion care
For the
that are
sake of fun.
personhood measures. Yes, and encourage state actors to treat eggs, embryos, and fetuses as if they are legally separate from the pregnant woman. So
Wait,
this
wait,
is
wait,
an
wait, wait.
yeah.
Eggs, but not sperm.
Right.
Sperm are totally, nobody cares, but an egg, that has to be treated like a human being.
Be
Right.
fertilized egg, I assume.
That could be their shorthand method of saying it. Yeah, it might be a
Okay.
fertilized egg. But yes, it's quite an astounding study. The things that they found that women just appear to be increasingly regarded as just the empty incubator for the fetus. And it's really quite frightening that I guess the impingement on their liberties that is occurring because of this. So it's a concerning study. It really is.
Well, and when I read the title, I thought it was going to be about the states where they've enacted, before you have an abortion, you have to have, a transvaginal ultrasound and be shown the heartbeat, which is
Right.
concerning enough. But the fact that, yeah, wow.
Yeah. And basically what they're saying is all the cases that they've identified, these arrests and other actions, they would not have happened but for the fact that the woman was pregnant at the time of the alleged violation. So it seems to be going backwards. Ever since 1973, this is why they chose the date of the study. That was the Roe versus Wade change in the law there.
That's really interesting. So, if a woman who is pregnant is smoking tobacco, not saying that you should smoke tobacco when you're pregnant, but if you do, then that could also be providing cigarettes to a minor.
Yes, smoking tobacco, drinking alcohol.
So this also kind of sounds like an attack. I know that a lot of people have problems with the idea that women can consume drugs and alcohol and endanger their fetuses before birth. And so I know I've heard some people, I know that's a really vague term because I can't think of a citation right now, but some people have advocated like, oh, well, we should, have these women who are at high risk of, for example, causing fetal alcohol syndrome, we should, lock them up and make sure they don't have alcohol and force them into rehab for the prevention of fetal alcohol syndrome.
Right, and where does it stop? Yes, as you mentioned, we know alcohol during pregnancy is a definite risk. So, what do you do with the woman who maybe has an alcohol problem and she's pregnant? Do you lock her up for 9 months, or perhaps a woman who smokes tobacco or has developed gestational diabetes? Do you lock her up for 9 months and make sure you force feed her insulin?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, or perhaps let's say she's gained too much weight or she's not gaining enough weight during her pregnancy. What the limits on her personal freedoms and liberties is a staggering thought.
Yeah, absolutely. Like the thing is criminalizing this sort of thing. I mean, I don't think any of us are arguing that not drinking alcohol in pregnancy is. Now I'm in a double negative, but I don't think any of us are arguing that we should be a lot of women should be out there drinking alcohol and smoking tobacco and marijuana in pregnancy. Like that's probably not a great idea.
No.
But by criminalizing it, you're preventing these women from seeking help and resources that are going to prevent them from doing it in the first place. Because they're coming forward and then they're going to get arrested. Like you want them to seek resources that are a positive kind of nurturing environment that allows them to deal with the reasons that
Right,
they're doing
right.
things.
And I also find it's the United States too, in that their laws seem to be a real patchwork and vary from state to state. So it may all depend too on where you're living, that your state may have these laws, the other next state may not. all of a sudden, you know, you're in the wrong state, literally, for, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and there's plenty of states that haven't technically outlawed abortion, but have effectively stopped women from being able to access it, and then neighboring states don't allow women from out of state to get an abortion there either, so you're kind of stuck.
Right.
Even though abortion isn't illegal, it's still mm-hmm. impossible to access unless you have friends in high places, I guess.
True, true, yes. And the measures that have been brought in place, as you mentioned, the transvaginal ultrasounds and things like that prior to being able to get an abortion, are restricting liberties across the board.
Well, and completely denying autonomy, right? It's saying that, well, you've made this decision, but have you really made this decision? Have you really thought about it, sweetheart?
Exactly, yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyway. All right. What else do you have for us, Jim?
What I do have is I'd like to remind everyone that all of the videos from Skeptic Camp Winnipeg 2012 are currently being posted. We've got half of them up so far. And the rest will be coming up in the next couple of weeks. You can find them, you can go to winnipegskeptics.com/skepticamp. You can find the links to Skeptic Camp Winnipeg 2012, and all of the videos and talks are on that page.
Excellent. And I, because I didn't attend this year, I will definitely be checking them out when I have some spare time. So, the next thing I want to talk about, there's definitely a medical trend in my articles this week, is that the Quebec government is proceeding with dying with dignity legislation, which is basically physician-assisted suicide being decriminalized.
Excellent.
Yeah. So the federal government is against physician-assisted suicide and euthanasia.
Allow me to contain my amazement.
Earlier this year, or I guess the previous year now, the BC government allowed Gloria Taylor, a woman in her 60s with ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease, to basically be euthanized, despite laws against it. And so that was overturned by the Supreme Court in BC, and she passed away late last year. And so now this has come up in Quebec as well. And I think, you know, as a future physician, I am torn in this for more of a personal reason than a, you know, official status. I believe that people have the right to autonomy, but at the same time, I'm not sure I'm comfortable with assisting a patient in dying, if that makes sense.
Now, if physician-assisted suicide were to be rendered legal, would you personally be required to, would any physician be required to
No.
help somebody? Would it be part of their practice?
No. One of the things that they've definitely made very clear is that anyone who is not comfortable with doing it is not going to be legally obligated to do so, much like other contentious issues. You know, a physician is not obligated to provide abortion, but they are obligated to provide access to someone who will give it.
There you go.
So, okay. You know, like I certainly am happy about the legislation and people being able to have that autonomy. It's more of just like a personal reservation of that dilemma if someone comes to me and wants that I'm not sure what I would do in that situation yet. I really haven't had enough time to truly
mull
it
over. So do you think
over.
You'd have reservations about allowing them access to that? About saying you can
no.
go here or no?
No, not at all. I think that people should have access to it. That there are plenty of awful terminal diseases, and if someone decides that it's not what they want to go through, if you're going to have the same outcome anyway, then I'm okay with that. As long as it's such a tough area, because you don't want to say, well, as long as it's for a good reason, because you want to rule out the people who are suicidal and depressed. You don't want to be euthanizing people who would otherwise not want to be euthanized.
But then again, I think maybe what it comes down to is quality of life. If somebody's quality of life, if their level of pain is no longer manageable, or their condition has made, you know, they have no enjoyment from life anymore. I mean, that's, I think, could be probably fairly easy to determine by the physician who was willing to assist in that circumstance.
Perhaps, but quality of life is hard to evaluate, and you can have psychological factors that limit somebody's quality of life. I'm not necessarily... obviously, I would rather that a person... how should I phrase this? I share Rochelle's reservations. If a person can... has the potential to live a happy and fulfilling and productive life, then I would be very sad if they decided to end their life. But even in those cases, I am not comfortable denying them that autonomy. Mm-hmm. I think that wherever possible, we should provide any assistance that we can to ensure that they have psychiatric help, if that seems to be the appropriate sort of help that they need. Mm-hmm. However, I'm not comfortable denying them that autonomy when push comes to shove.
Right.
Yeah. Well, it's, and one of the things that I heard about when I heard this story on the news is that just this week, a set of twins in Belgium, who I'm not going to attempt to pronounce their names and butcher them, but they were deaf, and both of them were slowly going blind. And they were only 45 years old, and rather than be both deaf and blind, they both committed suicide by euthanasia with the help of a physician. So it's sort of like, from the outside, you can say, oh, well, that's not a very good reason. And yet at the same time, I can understand why someone would not want to be completely cut off from the outside world.
Sure. And it's sort of on a similar note to what you were saying, Rochelle, when you were saying you're not sure if you would be comfortable at assisting in in euthanasia. I can't imagine a circumstance in which I would want to end my own life. However, the fact that I don't ever plan to, you know, I don't ever plan to make use of so many of the laws that I think we should have. I don't plan to, a good example?
Probably a good analogy is the whole concept of being pro-choice.
Sure.
I don't think I would ever be in a situation where I would want to utilize abortion services, but that doesn't mean that other people don't have the right to access them if they want them.
Sure.
Conversation killed.
No, abortion is a conversation killer? Surprising.
No, agreed. No, I appreciate your point, Jam, that you can never see a point where you would want to, you know, find life intolerable. But I'm just imagining that there would be conditions and times when people would, and perhaps what this kind of issue may require is a specialist or somebody who kind of really is familiar with the different issues and can sit down with the person ahead of time and say, this is what you want. Have you thought about this? Have you been given that? Have you tried this pain medication? Have you been, you know, so you're not just taking somebody says, okay, I want to end it all. And you're going, okay, no problem. But obviously there would be counseling involved, there would be preparation, there would be trying different things. And from a physician's point of view, if somebody has a condition that they know, the physician knows that this is, is not going to end well, it is just going to be increasingly difficult for the person, then that we can't deny them that right. That's right. Yeah. That should we can't know what it's like to be them.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And I do know that there is a group in Canada which provides anonymous support presently for people who wish to, you know, end their life in a safe way when they're struggling with chronic illness, and providing support and resources. They are off the books right now, obviously. And for the life of me, I cannot find the name of the...
It is the Hemlock Society.
Hemlock Society. Yeah. There we go. Yes. So the Hemlock Society does provide resources, but obviously they have to operate in a slightly less than legitimate way because what they're doing is technically illegal. So I would be glad to see these people providing resources under... the Dying with Dignity laws, because people should have access to information to make informed choices.
Agreed.
Absolutely. Okay, let's move on to our last news story.
Is this my my International Space Station story, perhaps?
This is your International Space Station story.
Yay, yay, yay. What NASA... I'm just thrilled about this one. What NASA did a little while ago is that they've given people the option and the ability to sign up at a special website. And what you can sign up for alerts for when the space station is going to be passing over your particular region. And it will send you alerts via text or email. So, and then you can head outside and take a look. So these little alerts will let you know the time, where it is in the sky, the direction it starts from and where it goes to. And so then all you need is a clear sky. So I've been receiving these alerts for a couple of months now. Sadly, though, it seems the space station likes to hit Winnipeg at around 6 a.m., and I'm sorry, that's just not going to happen. there's just no way. But and the other problem then is that the times when it's been here and it's been cloudy, so that kind of puts a damper on that too. But the other morning, beautiful clear morning, I stepped outside. I looked in the correct direction after being pointed out which was east, northeast, and what was west. And lo and behold, there it was. It was exciting. It's just a thrill to see that, and it is quite easy to spot. It is worth it, people. You're wondering if it's just going to be this tiny little speck in the sky. Well, no, it's not. It is an aircraft going high above. You can definitely see that it is more than just a little spot or a little circle. And you enjoy watching it traveling across the sky. And lately, with our wonderful Chris Hadfield up in space, tweeting pictures down from what he's seeing, this is amazing, people. These people are orbiting the planet several times. What is it, an hour? It's got to be. It's got to be that these folks are up there, and the communication is just amazing. So if you're interested at all, the website is spotthestation.nasa.gov. And all you have to do is enter your email address, tell them what country and city you're in, and they will send you those alerts. And believe me, go check it out. Go look up at the sky. It's amazing.
That sounds so cool. And don't forget to wave at Commander Chris Hadfield, and maybe he'll take your picture.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Excellent. All right. Well, I think that's all we have to talk about today. So I'd like to thank you guys for joining me for this little chat.
Oh, it was my pleasure.
It was fun. Thank you, Rochelle.
All right. So you've been listening to Life, the Universe, and Everything Else. You can email your questions, comments, or criticisms to us at lueepodcast@winnipegskeptics.com, or you can reach us on Twitter or Facebook at @lueepodcast. Our music is produced by the very talented Ian Leung.
So this is a thought experiment. On Twin Earth, a brain in a vat is at the wheel of a runaway trolley. There are only two options that the brain can take, the right side of the fork in the track or the left side of the fork. There is no way in sight of derailing or stopping the trolley, and the brain is aware of this, for the brain knows trolleys. The brain is causally hooked up to the trolley such that the brain can determine the course which the trolley will take. On the right side of the track, there is a single railroad worker, Jones, who will definitely be killed if the brain steers the trolley to the right. If the railman on the right lives, he will go on to kill five men for the sake of killing them. But in so doing, he will inadvertently save the lives of 30 orphans. One of the five men he will kill is planning to destroy a bridge that the orphan's bus will be crossing later that night. One of the orphans that will be killed would have grown up to become a tyrant who would make good utilitarian men do bad things. Another of the orphans would grow up to become G.E.M. Anscombe, while a third would invent the pop-top can. If the brain on the vat chooses the left side of the track, the trolley will definitely hit and kill a railman on the left side of the track, Lefty, and will hit and destroy 10 beating hearts on the track that could and would have been transplanted into 10 patients at a local hospital that will die without donor hearts. These are the only hearts available, and the brain is well aware of this, for the brain knows hearts. If the railman on the left side of the track lives, he too will kill five men. In fact, the same five men the railman on the right will kill. However, Lefty will kill the five men as an unintended consequence of saving 10 men. He will inadvertently kill the five men, rushing the 10 hearts to the local hospital for transplantation. A further result of Lefty's act would be that the busload of orphans will be spared. Among the five men killed by Lefty are both the man responsible for putting the brain at the controls of the trolley and the author of this example. If the 10 hearts and Lefty are killed by the trolley, then the 10 prospective heart transplant patients will die, and their kidneys will be used to save the lives of 20 kidney transplant patients, one of whom will grow up to cure cancer, and the other of whom will grow up to be Hitler. There are other kidneys and dialysis machines available. However, the brain does not know kidneys, and this is not a factor. Assume that the brain's choice, whatever it turns out to be, will serve as an example to other brains and vats, and so the effects of this decision will be amplified. Also assume that if the brain chooses the right side of the fork, an unjust war free of war crimes will ensue, while if the brain chooses the left fork, a just war fraught with war crimes will result. Furthermore, there is an intermittently active Cartesian demon deceiving the brain in such a manner that the brain is never sure if it is being deceived. What should the brain do? I remember reading about it on the news afterward. I don't remember if the guy survived. I think he did, but it was like a chest wound.
Yeah.
I lost my shirt. It was like my favorite shirt.